Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast. I'm very pleased to be joined today by my colleague, Father Raymond Troth. Thanks, Father Ray, for joining us.
Well, it's an honor to get a chance to just talk to you.
That's true. We don't often have a chance to just sit down one-on-one. We're talking about our anniversary of World War I issue, which is obviously the 100th anniversary of the start of the war. And we have an article by Oliver Rafferty looking at the legacy of the war, but also a more personal piece from Father Troth about your father and his service in World War I. So maybe you can introduce us to your father.
I think it has something to do with my moving into senior years myself. And there are moments in your life when you have to ask yourself, who are you? Who are you yourself? Are you you or are you your father? And I've been rather fascinated by various themes that come back from his life into mine. And the key one that seems to sum it all up is his the participation in World War I, because that's where he was 24, 25 years old or something like that, and he was at the height of his powers. He was a young newspaper man, self-made in many ways because he was not able to go to college, and he had to go work in a brickyard when he was 12 years old, when his father died in order to help feed the family. He had two brothers, an older brother who became a very well-known newspaper publisher. He owned the Brooklyn Eagle. And another brother who had the tragedy of depression in his life, and we never talked about him. I met him by accident one day when he visited our home and we were little kids. And I said, who is this man? And this was my Uncle John, whom I had never met. So my father, in many ways, was a very public person. Most respected citizen in the city of Trenton. But there are other things in his life he never talked about. And he wasn't good at expressing his feelings. And so here I am getting a little edging up on the age he was when he passed away at 86. I'm not quite near that now. But I just sort of beginning to put things together in my own head.
Now, his is a very interesting story. And as you said, he wasn't like fresh out of high school or something. He had already established himself as a reporter. So yeah. He was going in as somebody who was already had a career.
Yeah.
And what's remarkable, too, as you kind of fill in some of the history of what was happening in the time as the United States was ready to go to war itself, as he was preparing for the war, you said the troops were not really that well prepared. It had been a long time since the United States
fought. The army was very small.
Yeah.
Right. And just as the Second World War was preceded by a period of isolationism, so was the First World War. I mean, people were living high and having a great time. And the idea that that the war in Europe had something to do with us, that people didn't think about that.
So your father, where was he first sent to as a soldier?
Landed at Dieppe, I think. I'm pretty sure on that. And then I don't know exactly. I don't know all of his moves before the Argonne campaign.
Right.
For a long while, the American troops were not used at all because Pershing did not want to put them under the commands of French or British generals because he figured they would send his kids in there, his young men, into battle before they were ready. And therefore, a lot of the training that they had done at Fort Dix, a lot of that was repeated once they got into France. And then it was in the last year of the war. Remember, the scene that I describe is in November 1st of 1918, and the war is going to end within a week. But it ends at the end of what is called the Meuse-Argonne campaign, in which I'm no good at statistics unless I have them in front of me, And the combined American, French, and British forces moved south to north through this vast forest, which was in many ways impenetrable. But full of shell holes and mud and junk. And this took many weeks before they got to the Grand Pre, which was the sort of the center of that movement. Now the purpose of it is to break through the Hindenburg line into Germany.
There's a remarkable story here about this battle, which you write about, and the part your father played. Maybe you can tell that story.
It's the morning of November 1st, and the heavy part of the battle, the heavy bombardments, which to the, I'm sure, the surprise of many people who read this, the American forces used gas, just the way the Germans used gas. It was mustard gas for the most part, but some of the stuff was worse. So we gassed them and we bombed them and we strafed them with these planes that the people, Colonel Rickenbacker was flying one of the planes at the time. I just read a biography of him the other day. So that's softening them up. Now, it's important to understand the terrain here. It's a collection of mini mountains within a mile or so of one another. As if you travel in southern France, this is sort of more to the north, though, it's a lot of hills with little towns on the top. And that's what they had right here, with several, one of which was called Grand Pre. And at the top of the hill was an old sort of battlement or chateau from which the Germans could one see all what was happening in the fields and woods below them, and also they would line the sides of the hill with machine gun nests. The machine gun was a relatively new weapon during this war, and it was the main one, and the French, we all had it, but the Germans just used them collectively and in a very devastating way. This one machine gun nest was impeding, what I'm doing here is I'm quoting the official documents, was impeding the American advance. Namely, we're not going to be able to take all of this town. We had taken part of the town the day before. We're not going to be able to take it all, or we're not going to break through the line unless we get rid of that spot, clean up that spot so our army can go through. My father was, as a master sergeant, is head of a platoon. The officer in charge of a platoon is either a captain or a lieutenant. I myself, much later in the 50s, I was a lieutenant. I was a commander of a platoon. So about 50, 60, to a company would be 100 men. A platoon would be maybe 20, 30. Attack that gun and get it out. And so they attack it under terrific fire, and many of our men are being killed. And they're also turning around and running. And in fact, so the commanders behind, I think, approved for these people escaping. They're trying to save their lives. And then my father is suddenly caught there alone, a few yards from the target itself, with three or four other guys who stayed with him. And he says to them, "Beat it. I'll go and I'll finish this off." As they approached, first of all, they thought that the Germans were quitting, and they thought that they were falling back. But all of a sudden, the German forces rose up over the edge of the hill and are fighting like hell. And my father, I guess he kills them. He never used those words.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
He disposes or drives out, drives away,
right,
those persons, leaving one person there as his prisoner. So now his job is to bring the prisoners back to the American front. Because they try to do that, but the bombardment is still going on. And as you can see from any of the wonderful, the horrible photographs of the battlefields, how they're all mud. They're all mud with holes in it. And made by, the holes are made by all these bombs and the grenades and all that stuff. So my father and this German guy have to dive into one of these holes and sort of hustle in there, huddle up there, and stay there until the bombardment's over so they can try to get back to American lines. And this is a familiar scene. If you remember All Quiet on the Western Front,
right, yeah.
But Lou Ayres has a corpse, a German corpse there.
Oh, right. And he goes through his
staring
wallet.
At him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so he imagines... little illusions of delusions of, as if the guy's alive and about to talk to him in a movie or in the novel.
But your father actually had a living German with
him. He had a living person.
Yeah.
And I guess my father knew three or four words of German.
Yeah.
because he said, I guess they exchanged their names and then family, how's your family? And my father says to the German, reaches into his wallet and says, "Das ist mein Schwester," right? My father, I guess that means he's got a sister.
Right, right, yeah,
so,
yeah.
So my father says, "This is my sister, Mary," and et cetera, et cetera. And he has another, Margaret, he had another sister who was a nun at the time. Mary died quite early from cancer. So, it eases up, and they continue back, and of course my father has his pistol out, aimed at this guy, you know, don't try to run or don't try anything. See? What the German does not know, it's not loaded, it's empty.
Yeah.
He used all his bullets at the top of the hill, and now he's going to pretend that he's got a weapon and brings the guy back.
So they made it back.
Yeah,
they made it back. And he received a special commendation for this.
The Distinguished Service Cross.
You have a wonderful picture in here of members of the 78th Division, including your father, receiving these awards in France.
Yeah. He told me one. My father had a dry sense of humor, even on things like that. And then he said, the General Foch pins this medal on my father, and he said, "Sergeant Schroth, it is deeds like yours that have made the American Army invincible." And then shakes hand, goes to the next guy. "Sergeant so-and-so, Captain so-and-so, it's deeds like yours." He said that to everybody in that line.
Now, you said your father didn't speak much about the war, yet it seemed to be, in your estimation, kind of the defining event of his life. So much so that you write here that he even tried to sign up for World War II.
Yeah,
He was a 50-year-old man, but wanted to serve.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the more you read about war and veterans, the more you hear the same story. They don't want to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to talk about it. And but he had... The way I see it now, he had indirect ways of getting it out. I think I mentioned in the story there when we were, you know, you're a little kid, you're four or five or something, and your father comes and tells you bedtime stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember him telling me the stories of the war, namely a very vivid description of trench warfare. Now, everybody's lined up, and they go out over the trenches, and then they have to charge through the barbed wire, and wave after wave of them are all shot down.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And here I am listening to
it's
this.
It's kind of a scary bedtime story.
Yeah, But I took it pretty well. I mean, I didn't lose any sleep or cry or anything, but I never forgot it.
Yeah.
And then... the other stories about him, that I mentioned in there, I did not hear further directly from him, but many of his, in those days, you went to war with your city. You were, everybody was in,
it was regional.
Enlisted from Trenton.
Oh, okay.
Right? And then the Fort Dix at that time had not even been built. And it was being built, put together, while these people were being enlisted.
Right.
So therefore, after the war, his best friends were Trenton people who had been to war with him and have joined the American Legion. They formed the first, one of the first battalions or companies of the American Legion in Trenton there. And my father was the first commander. And they sponsored a baseball team called the Shroths, and they had the American Legion League. It was a national league and championship and all that stuff, right? But it would be one of these guys who would say, did you ever hear about your father on the ship going over when they wanted to have some entertainment and they decided to put on a boxing match between the between the Navy and the Army? And I said, no, he never told me. And then, well, we chose your father was going to represent the United States Army, and then they had a sailor there.
Mm-hmm.
And so they get in the ring, and the Navy guy, they go into a clinch, and the Navy guy says, hey, look, let's not take this too seriously, all right? It's just it's just an entertainment for our pals, right?
Mm-hmm.
And my father said, let every man do his best. And he knocked him out of the ring. Now, I believe it because, first of all, I did not hear it first from him. And then he told it again, and it said that was true.
So that's a true story.
Yeah.
Do you get any sense? I mean, you also served, as you said, you were in the Korean War.
No, I just missed it. I graduated from Fordham in 55, and I had 2 years in the service. And 55 and 57 in Germany.
In Germany.
But the Korean War was
just over.
It just ended. It just in time.
But that's obviously, we were still occupying parts of Germany as of the post-war.
Yeah, still the presumption was when I went to college that I was going to end up in the Army because everybody either was drafted or was ROTC.
Yeah.
And I figured, well, I might as well be an officer with a college education if I'm going to go in.
Yeah.
So that's...
But that what you mentioned there about your father having all these friends from the Army who then he kind of raised his families with, they all lived in the same neighborhood.
Yeah.
Maybe that helped those soldiers, even though they didn't talk about the war.
Yeah.
They had that community, which now doesn't really exist for soldiers returning home.
Well, the American Legion was a great part of that.
Right, yeah.
But also... my father's battalion had regular reunions.
Ah, okay.
Now, I'm not sure it was every year, but for a while I had the impression it was. And so we were little kids, and veterans would come in from outside the town,
mm-hmm.
and we would put them up in our house. Some of them. Then they would all go to a restaurant,
mm-hmm.
and they have this feast or dinner, have a grand time. And then the ones who were staying with us, they'd come back and they'd stay up later and tell their stories. But they had a ritual. As the evening goes on, everybody's getting pretty high. Somebody at the far end of the table stands up and he picks up this wine bottle and he holds it back and he flings that bottle right into the crowd of the diners of the people at the table. But the bottle was made of rubber. Right? And so they're playing with their emotions. You know, they know, and I think they did the same thing every year, so everybody knows it's a rubber bottle. But there's a sensation of disaster is coming, and then it's not.
Right, right.
And you can laugh it off.
Yeah.
So
it's a release for them.
Yeah, I think that has something to, I just thought of it now. I think it has something to do with the wound of the war.
Right, yeah. Now, as somebody who has since then, as you said, you served yourself, and then you've written a lot about war as, you know, somebody here in America, but also in other capacities as a journalist, how do you think your father's experience shaped your own views about war and peace?
The first thing that was very deep in my convictions it was patriotism. It never really occurred to me that America could serve an unjust war. I didn't think it was because we knew that World War II was to get Hitler, and somehow I was convinced that World War I was to save make the world safer democracy, which is what they said in those days. And then after I had made up my mind during active duty, if we had to go into combat, it would be against Russia, or it was right around the time of the Russian invasion of Hungary. And it was a lot of toward Czechoslovakia. We were doing our training on the Czechoslovakian border, and the officers in my battalion were delighted. They really hoped we could go to war because that's what they're here for. I mean, that's why they were in the army, to fight battles, and they want to get promoted and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I was not enthusiastic about that, but I figured I would participate, and if necessary, I'd kill people until it was something clear that it would be wrong. So if someone says, bomb that house, and I know that there are civilians in there, I would refuse. And if I wanted to be court-martialed, tough. I mean, I'd be court-martialed, and that's the way I would approach it. Then I joined the Jesuits, and then the Vietnam War was evolving in the mid-60s. And that became a moral issue, and then I began to look at the moral issue of the Vietnam War and study just war theory. And here I was. Not becoming a pacifist, but changing my opinion that my country can be unjust, and my country can be unfair, it can be guilty. And I was a little nervous with how I was going to explain this to my father, because my father was very much a Democrat and Roosevelt, and certainly did not like Nixon at all. But felt he had to support the troops in Vietnam. And I was home at Christmas time, at the time of the bombing, of the big bombings of Hanoi, which was sort of a boundary line, of sort of a moral boundary
yeah.
line. If you accept that, you're going to accept anything. And he was getting older. And he reads the news carefully all the time, and he just, I remember him shaking his head and sort of almost like a sob or a sigh, with all those poor, dead, innocent people. And to him now, it was the wrong war. And he was on my side.
Yeah, right. Well, that's a whole different experience for somebody who came, you know, as you say, patriotism was so much part of who he was. And
yeah.
then to see that development of, you know, our country's involvement in other kinds of war,
yeah.
that tells the story of, the in many ways, the 20th century
yeah.
in this country. Well, Father Ray, thank you so much for sharing these stories of your father. And we will recommend this article to all of our listeners.
Well, thanks a lot. And I hope we get rid of the war that we're involved in right now.
Yeah, yeah. That'll be the next podcast.
Yeah.
Thanks again, Father Ray.